Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton, the creator and host of the series. For anybody there who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I created this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current challenges to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. And I've now held over 90 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. Once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. Today I'm joined by Tom Steininger. We'll continue that discussion in a conversation entitled My Guru Experiment, 20 Years with Andrew Cohen. The way this will work is I'll introduce Tom, we'll dialogue for about an hour, then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions. So we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Tom Steininger studied philosophy and earned his PhD at the University of Vienna with a special emphasis on awareness issues and social evolution. He worked for the Austrian radio as a freelance journalist and then became a student of the spiritual teacher Andrew Cohen in 1990. He ultimately became a senior student and key leader of Andrew's students in Germany. He is a founder and currently an editor of the German Evolve magazine for consciousness and culture and was for a long time its senior editor. Tom taught at the Master's Program for Conscious Evolution at the Graduate Institute in Connecticut in collaboration with Don Beck, Suzanne Cook-Greuter, and Alan Combs. And today he's leading Enlighten Next Germany and Switzerland, which is the only surviving part of what was formerly Andrew's nationwide organization. It's now really its own thing, not part of Andrew's organization. He's also co-founded with Integral and Anthroposophical Partners, the Autumn Academy in Frankfurt, and is a leader in many new expressions of translineage dialogue. He moderates the web radio show Radio Evolve. He also lectures internationally and teaches courses on evolutionary spirituality. What I appreciate about Tom is his combination of several rare virtues. First, he's really smart, well-educated, very with it, very aware. Second, he has a very inquisitive, spiritually awake intellect, which makes him a very good listener, able to stay ongoingly curious in a way that keeps him learning and developing beyond any of his preconceived attitudes. Also, he's developed a deep, self-transcending commitment to make a positive difference, serving the awakening of consciousness and culture. He gets many of the most important issues of our time in a deep way and cares about them. And yet, he and I, even though we mostly do agree with each other about many things, we've also been able to disagree productively. And he's done this with many others, creating larger structures of cooperation that can hold a diversity of perspectives and values. And thus, I think he's a very productive, creative, and collaborative brother in the great work. So welcome, Tom. I'm so happy to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you so much for your introduction, and I'm very happy to be here and join you for this conversation.
Well, great. Well, let's kick it off by asking the obvious question, given the title of we've chosen for this dialogue. Why don't you just tell us the basic sense of what this is that you're calling your guru experiment? What was it exactly? What happened? What did you learn?
I mean, first, I think I have to start that I really started this as a guru experiment because I had spiritual experiences. I was on the spiritual path for many years. After I studied philosophy in Vienna and Austria, I worked as a psychotherapist and for the Austrian radio, and I had spiritual teachers, and I really was seeking for someone I could work with to really really look for something that is beyond myself, something absolute. and also to really work my own ego. And I know that I at that time I really looked around and I was looking for someone who's really challenging me. And the main I think the main reason why I was puzzled when I saw Andrew Cohen is I found someone who I felt was radical in a very unusual way, and someone where I felt I find the challenge that I was looking for. And in many ways, good ways and maybe also not so good ways, I did meet this challenge, and this is basically what we want to talk about. Because maybe also to say, what I would like to talk about here is just my own story. I know there are many stories around Andrew, good ones and definitely also not so good ones. But I have to say that this time with Andrew Cohen, and it's 20 years by now, was for me a very important time, which I don't want to miss. At the same time, although we learned a lot, there's also a lot I have to learn about the mistakes we made, mistakes Andrew made, but also the mistakes we made as a culture around Andrew. And I would like to just open the question, so what was this? What was pulling me? It was definitely first pulling me just to go beyond my ego and find something that you can call the ground of being, the absolute, and had very deep spiritual experiences. But more and more with the experiment around Andrew Cohen, it was also going to a place of coming together as human beings beyond ego, where we made a lot of spiritual effort, to put it that way, to really find a place of something like a higher we. And I had some experiences, maybe we can go into this later, we had some experiences with this effort that are still very, very important for me, and they're very they're the foundation of my work still. And in that sense, I'm very grateful for what I experienced there.
Okay. Well, just a moment, Tom. I'm going to have to mute you when I'm talking because of an echo. That kind of creates an overview here. But I think what's really interesting about this is to get into the fine points of it. So, you know, Andrew is really well known for, you know, on the one hand, having engaged some very significant dharmic innovations, his transition from what he called impersonal enlightenment to evolutionary enlightenment, his embrace of higher intersubjectivity and enlightened communications, the leadership in terms of a lot of new ideas, particularly evolutionary ideas, through his, well, it's not only his, but all of you together creating the magazine, What is Enlightenment, later Enlightened Next, and all of what it published. And I know you created a German edition of that magazine, which at first translated the English edition, but then had its own content and now continues publication in German even since the English language magazine has stopped. There's a lot of creativity and ferment that has contributed. That's on the positive side. And I would say there are other positives. But the other side of it is there have been a lot of negatives. Andrew's very controversial. There's three books that I know of off the top of my head that are all about essentially how bad he is, one of them by his mom. So there are the specifics of what worked and what didn't work. And I think for you to unpack that a little bit more deeply is actually the stuff of this, and to do that in a way that is well, I guess, you know, in the spirit of your very honest and self-critical you know, awareness, which you've shared with me before in conversations that we've had, you know, what was courageous and true about this impulse to have this experiment? Where were you naive in some ways? In what ways did you make mistakes? In what ways was Andrew making mistakes? And in what ways did something really productive emerge? And, you know, what is the wheat and what is the chaff? How do you separate the different dimensions of this experiment? Please unpack your process for us.
Definitely. I think that the problem is also that it's hard for me to really separate this completely, because to some degree, some part that really made happen what I think is very productive, you cannot separate from also what were the flaws of what we did. Because having a guru relationship, that's why I call it also the guru experiment, is a certain relationship you go into where you do something quite extraordinary, at least to my understanding of what a guru relationship is. You make a choice to trust someone more than yourself, because you trust that this is a leverage to pull you beyond your own ego. This is a very powerful relationship, and it's completely based on trust. And on one hand, this is something that is, I think, powerful, like not many things are powerful, and at the same time, it's dangerous. So it's very much related to purity of motive. And what I experienced, that because I made this decision and I also was looking for this, because I, of whatever reasons, naive reasons, mystic reasons, maybe smart reasons, I don't know, I thought this is something I need, I was looking for, to have a human relationship with someone I can trust deeply. At the same time, I know I was questioning myself, is this a crazy thing to do? I still remember at that time in the early 90s, when I was still in Vienna, I had a cousin who I was very close to, and I discussed everything. He still lives in Vienna, and at some evening, one evening, we were together in the sauna, as we did every week, and I just asked him, should I really do this? This may be a completely crazy thing to do, to join a teacher like that. Also a teacher who at that point already had a kind of a radical way how he showed himself, and go into this kind of relationship. Is this for a 20th century guy who thinks that he's an adult human being, something to do? And my cousin said, Thomas, I think if you don't do this, you end up as a cynical Viennese intellectual like all these Viennese cynical intellectuals. So, in fact, he had quite a part in my decision at that time, because I felt there's a huge risk in this, but I have to take this risk for my, let's put it, soul's sake. And then when you do this, and this is also the downside of going into something like a guru relationship, you make a choice of trust. And from the beginning, there were a lot of things that I had difficulties with, that were not what I thought was right. And looking back, I was not always wrong. But at that time, I also made the choice, and that's the danger of this situation, to trust more my trust into a human being, Andrew, is it, than my own critical understanding. And I have to say, besides the fact that it to some degree made me naive, and that's the downside of it, it also helped me to go to places, to look at the places in my own ego. I think, I mean, you never know what would have happened otherwise, but I think I would have not gone otherwise, because when you trust someone who really is pushing you to go beyond your own arrogance, I mean, I was kind of an arrogant guy, and Andrew humiliated me, in fact, right away. And just to tell this story also, because I think it's part of it, where I also say, in that sense, I personally, I would have it hard to blame Andrew, because he was very honest to me. When at a certain point, Andrew started a first German community at that time in Cologne, and I wanted to be part of this German community. He said, Thomas, you won't be able to join this community. Your ego is much too big for this small community. So basically, he didn't allow me to join. And then I really wanted to be part of this, so I just tried different ways, and then I suggested that maybe I would come to California, because at that time he was living in Marin County, and I thought maybe this is the way to go. And it took quite some while, and he didn't let me. But at some point, he accepted me to come to California to join his community there. But he said to me, it will be 10 times more hell than you think. So whatever you think, maybe it's crazy on my part, but I have to admit there was something that attracted me, that someone was challenged me in that way, and that partly created my naivete, but partly also allowed me to develop in ways that I still think was very helpful for me.
Now, I have to keep remembering here. I think Brad, I need you to jump in on this as best you can. Help me with that. You know, Tom, I have heard from others who were with Andrew in those early days that at that time there was a great deal of transmission that people were feeling around him, like a quality of a field of enlightened awareness that was palpable and was a big part of the experience of a lot of his early students. Was that a factor for you? You didn't mention it as you described that early time.
Definitely it was. Interesting enough, when I think back, there was a transmission with him, but I think I really was mostly attracted by the challenge, to be honest. I was looking for a challenge. I had an experience with Andrew that he's something which I felt he's real, and we can talk about it, what I mean with him being real. But he had a transmission of something beyond himself, a transmission of some depth that I found very promising, let's put it that way. So it definitely had a big a part in this. But interesting enough, when I think back, I think more about the challenge. But maybe that's the distortion of memory.
Well, I certainly know that I felt attracted when I came to my guru, because you know, I have a parallel experience. I was with Adi Da for 15 years, and my 15 years with him was born of a recognition that there were aspects of my own consciousness that were just self-reinforcing, that the premise that I was beginning with, my bondage in my own patterns of mind and patterns of motivation, were so strong that I needed to be associated with something that was really free of all that if I was to break free. But I felt most attracted to a field of radiant, enlightened clarity that I felt. So it was a little bit different. However, I feel like we're working with a profound paradox, and maybe the fundamental problem that all of this addresses needs to be spelled out a little bit. I penned a blog post about a year ago, "Are You in a Cult?" And I basically said that everybody's in a cult. The whole world is a cult. And I quoted a wonderful thing the Dalai Lama has said, that in this world we sacrifice our health in order to make money. Then we squander our money trying to regain our health. We are so concerned about the future, we never live in the present, and then we die without ever having lived. And that summary of what the consensus trance, as Charles Tart has described it, of the world is serious, and our world crisis is a reflection of that consensus trance. And I pointed out that when you get serious about trying to break out of that consensus trance and you try to find others to support you in that, and you try to get the coherence of perspective to break out of the profoundly self-reinforcing gravity of that consensus trance, that's when your friends and family will begin asking you if you've joined a cult. And so there is a a need for us to have a space in which there can be experiments that are even bold and that may be very, very challenging and that may seem on certain levels a little bit bizarre. So I've been a bit of a defender, sometimes even of Andrew, and certainly of the experiment I had because I benefited so much from it. On the other hand, the potential for people to be dislodged from their network of human supports, for them to begin to lose perspective, and for that to be oriented in a way that has something pathological associated with it is serious. And we've seen from what's happened most recently with Andrew and Enlightened Next that there were extremes. You know, Andrew has said some extreme things. The most extreme line I've heard from it is, you should strangle your inner child in its crib. and that kind of harshness seems like it really was overblown. And that's why there has been, to a significant degree, a breakdown in the international organization of Enlightened Next. So you must be reflecting on the ways in which there was something unhealthy there, too. And I'm curious how that has unfolded for you and how you're reflecting on that now.
First, I'm not sure if I agree with you in terms of the harshness. Because there are definitely enlightened masters who have been very harsh, really very harsh, and have come from the right place. And I think harshness in itself is difficult because harshness is just very dangerous. Can be for the right people also the right thing to do. The question is, does it come from the right place, and does the one who does it have the right judgment to do it where it helps and not where it destroys, where it destroys the wrong thing? So I wouldn't say harshness per se is something bad. I think sometimes harshness can be powerful, particularly if people choose for this. I'm talking in my own case because I chose harshness. I did. Maybe it was pathological. We can talk about this, but I chose it. So it's not necessarily the harshness itself. I think is the issue. The issue is the motivation, and I completely agree that maybe all the time through, but particularly from a certain time on, it was very obvious that what Andrew did. First, did not just come from the right place, and also had very destructive results. And a lot of the breakdown of the international Enlightened Next community, and also the breakdown of many of the good things that were created there, are rooted in this. Second, I think we have to distinguish two different levels. Where the problem, I think, arises. One is a philosophical one and one is a personal one. Because I think you also, you don't understand someone like Andrew if you don't look at the time that he's in and the time that he's responding to. And here I seem a little bit parallel to Ken and both men's response to postmodernity. Because postmodernity's kind of values of pluralism and just mutual understanding was a beautiful achievement of culture, but it created its own downsides. And in the 80s, 90s, it became the downside of nihilistic pluralism and kind of a spirituality that was just a wellness spirituality in many senses were very obvious. So to describe what I think was the case, not with Andrew at this point, but with Ken, is that Ken made this powerful move in his term in a more intellectual and not in the guru spiritual sense, that he said pluralistic views is great, it's fantastic, but reality can be integrated. There can be also intellectually a oneness, and that he created his integral theory, and not by chance he called one book of himself a theory of everything. And it was a very powerful move to really say, no, it's not
not everything is relative. You can integrate it. But I think, similar to what Andrew is doing, there's a mistake in Kant's theory in that sense that this is a dialectical move against the relativism to say everything can be integrated in one theory. But as integral theory also unfolds, it's also obvious that when it comes to the detail, it doesn't really hold. And I think as integral matures more, and it's not so necessary to push against the cultural meme of postmodernity, you can mature also in that sense that you can reintegrate and have to reintegrate the positive values of postmodernity in that sense, to reintegrate also pluralism in a way where I think that integral and mature integral culture is more a culture of a dialogue than one integrated theory. That's on the theoretical. And I think Andrew did a similar move on the spiritual guru path, that he basically, he really was pushing this absoluteness against the relativism. And I think to say no, spirit is not just psychological, spirit is not just well-being, it's about absoluteness, it's beyond ego, and you have to push for it. It was a powerful move. But in itself, it was just an antithesis to postmodern relativism. I think, in a mature way, you have to integrate that. And there were a lot of mistakes that Andrew made, I think, on the theoretical level here. So this is a theoretical level. And in addition to that, I think there are a lot of personal motives of Andrew. And I mean, I'm not Andrew's psychologist, I don't know, but there are motives where he kind of created a harshness and not caring for personal souls that created just a lot of damage, and this is part of the crisis that he created.
Wow. You know, I think I should, as a matter of full disclosure, say a few things on my side. I felt some nervousness about doing this dialogue because there are people who feel very passionately about Andrew and Enlighten Next, their experience, many people who had some period of time of being his students, who occupy such a wide spectrum of positions, you know, people who really feel that their lives have been transformed positively by their work with Andrew, who've gained things and whose understanding of spirituality has been so positively impacted that there's something that they have invested here that, you know, on a positive side, that's really crucial. And there are many who feel critical, some extremely critical, some who feel outraged about how he's rolled and what he's done and who will testify and have put in writing how they've been horribly harmed by him and others have been horribly harmed. And it's very hard to say one thing to a room full of people who are so diverse, you know, and I look at this as a virtual room in which we're having this conversation. For all these paradoxes and nuances, you know, without triggering accusations of either being an apologist and an enabler of this kind of guru abuse or taking a lazy cop-out and throwing out some of the baby with the bathwater. You know, my history is that I did visit Andrew when he was in Marin County in about 1990, around the time you became a student, and I was just totally turned off. I just walked away feeling like there was something about it that just stunk to high heaven. I wasn't interested. I had no interest in anything he was doing for quite a while after that. But as I saw what was happening in the magazine, I began to read it and pay attention. And as he went from impersonal enlightenment to evolutionary enlightenment and his experiments with enlightened communication came forth, I was really intrigued, and I went to see him when he came to the Bay Area at one point, and then I actually went out in 2003 to a weekend retreat at Fox Hollow. But again, my exposure to him didn't resonate, so I was a little bit turned off again. But as I began to teach internationally, I kept meeting people like you and others who were so serious, so sincere, and so willing to challenge themselves, and really many times in a room full of integral people, some of the brightest lights in the room would turn out to be Andrew's students. And I thought that what he was putting forward with evolutionary enlightenment and interpersonal awakening were really important, that whatever he was doing that I didn't like the feel of, it was he was using that to innovate in directions that I felt were right on, based on my own direct spiritual experience. And then I saw him elaborating that in beautiful ways in his Guru Pandit dialogues with Ken Wilber in the pages of the magazine. So at one point I attended an event he did, one of the first events where his students came together with integralists at what's now the Boulder Integral Center. And when he finished his talk, I raised my hand. It was the first question. And I said, Andrew, if what you're saying is true, you're going to have partnerships with people who do not submit to you, who are not your students. And you've got to be willing to collaborate as equals with others. Are you really willing to do that? It was kind of a challenging question, but he responded unhesitatingly, yes, I absolutely am. And on that basis, I began to establish a different kind of relationship with him, and I found him able to do that, although not always as good a listener as I wanted. And in that place, I was able to challenge him very directly and to tell him that I thought that he was bringing in important dharmic innovations, but that his whole demeanor, his whole way of doing it was too arrogant, too imperious, and that a kind of receptivity and sympathetic resonance with people was really, really important. And he listened to me to some degree. He could see that I was supporting something in what he was doing, but he couldn't listen to it fully. And then we've seen what's happened to Enlighten Next. He said to me in recent time, and I have talked with him since his, whatever we call it, this whole unraveling of the international community, he said he wished he had listened, because maybe what has happened wouldn't have happened if he'd been able to listen more deeply. So that all takes place in the context of my really feeling that I've benefited tremendously from my own guru experiment with Adi Da. And my feeling that there's an attitude in the world that the age of the guru is over, that all guru models are inherently unhealthy, that surrendering your own dominion over yourself to a guru is inherently pathological. And there's almost an anti-guru, anti-cult zeitgeist that asserts really that there's no legitimacy in this mode of teaching at all. And I can appreciate how that attitude arises because of many real dynamics. And there's a valid humanism and humanistic values that I resonate with behind that thesis. But I think that it tends to throw out the baby with the bathwater, and especially because I'm so grateful to be who I became from my so-called victimization, the many difficult experiences that were excruciating for me with my experience with Adi Da. I got so much because of who he was and the awakening that was transmitted to me. So there is a lot of levels of paradox and a lot in this experiment that matters a lot to me. And I just confessing that and being more fully disclosing about my own relationship to this, I wonder if that stimulates any thoughts from you, Tom.
I mean, the main thought is I'm just very aware how I'm in the midst of it, because the story is not over. I don't know where Andrew will go after his sabbatical. I have to seriously think about the guru model as you were describing it, because I very much was looking for this guru model, and I tremendously benefited from it. I have to say. Right now, I'm not sure how this can be developed in a time like this, and maybe we have to go beyond guru in that sense. Maybe not, because I'm in very I have a lot of contradictions in myself. Because on one hand, I just deeply deeply value the possibility to trust someone in this unbelievable sense that you that this kind of spiritual relationship has. And I personally would say I know there's nothing but having this trust. That's an unbelievable, powerful human relationship. How this can be developed in the 21st century, maybe there are new ways to find it. Maybe I'm too much in the midst of it also because I'm just moving out in a post-guru-centric relationship myself, and I have to kind of also give it time for myself to think about it. So on one hand, I am deeply aware of the positive power of this human relationship. And on the other hand, I'm also thinking, are there different new ways to hold the same depth, to create the same trust in a more collective way, to create natural hierarchy in a different way than in this pyramid hierarchy that we created in Enlightened Next? That's at least something I'm deeply convinced of, that the pyramid hierarchy, as we had it, and I think we had the archetype of the pyramid hierarchy, that this is something that does not hold our time, that we have to move beyond that. I'm deeply convinced that we need hierarchy. I'm deeply convinced that we need natural hierarchy in the sense that the places that people have to give more, it also they have to have the chance that they can give more. If someone is more trustworthy, he's also worthy of being trusted more. But how this is how this unfolds, I'm in the process of finding out. In fact, right now, we're in the midst of a production of our German magazine Evolve, which is called Thinking Leadership New, Beyond Control and Consensus. Where we discuss not so much directly in the spiritual context, but more in the worldly context, how leadership can be thought in a different way. And I don't have the answer yet. I know I profited very much from having this relationship. I know particularly the pyramid structure of it, a lot of cultish behavior and also destructive structures and destructive results in human souls. There are different, more alive, more collaborative ways to do that. And at the same time, I'm deeply convinced we do need hierarchy much more than possible, and people like to admit that we need hierarchy. How this comes together, I don't know.
Well, there are many, different dimensions of this question, Tom, one of them being that is the spiritual process a science of personal development? There's a new book out by Sam Harris, The New Atheist, called Waking Up, in which he validates a rational approach that is entirely materialistic, essentially. And it's really just about waking up to the user illusion, the fact that there really is no self, and understanding that mental states affect perceptions, and using neuroscience as a basis for kind of being a smarter user of the human body-mind, and there being a value in a certain waking up. And it's an intelligent view, and it creates a roadmap to a meeting place between science and spirituality that would have very benign social effects of various kinds. But it is absolutely in contradiction to the panpsychic view, the idea that this is a psychophysical world and that their consciousness is at the root of everything, and that there is more than just brain states to our higher states of consciousness, and maybe more meaning. And I think that that view, which is certainly the integral and panentheist view, the truly spiritual view, is in some ways challenged by the by all the different ways in which people get involved in just silly New Age delusions on the one hand, or abuses of power and abuses of authority. You know, some of the stories about what Andrew is alleged to have done to people are pretty hair-raising. And it does appear that there were failures of empathy, at least huge failures of empathy and of care that were operationalized in that context. There was something pathological. And Andrew seems now to recognize that there were things he was asking his students to go through that he didn't go through himself. I feel a lot of compassion for him at this point because I want to see, I mean, number one, he's a human being. Like any human being, he's on a journey, and his journey matters. But number two, he's only treated me with genuine respect and consideration. I've had a different kind of relationship with him than anybody who was his student. And I see the potential for him to turn a corner, which could be profoundly useful to others. If someone could go through this and come out the other end with a broken heart and be actually able to empathize and love in the sense of agape, not just eros, other people, and to repent in a deep way of the ways in which he hurt people, but to still stand in whatever was true in his enlightenment, because it was obviously something to me, obviously something true, because he could have reached in a lot of different directions, but he went toward evolutionary spirituality, he went toward intersubjective enlightenment, things which I think genuinely are on the forefront of where things are evolving. So my hope is that there's a potential for him to turn things around in a different way in himself, and that might become a very useful lesson and example to others. I would love to see that. But the conversations tend to get polarized, such as people are just looking at this horrendous pathological abuse, which clearly must have taken place, at least at some level, and simply want to throw everything out on the basis of that. Or they look at the things that are valuable and they want to somehow justify things that really aren't justifiable on the basis of the values that have been held. And having been so close to this and having to walk the razor's edge and sort the wheat from the chaff again and again, I suspect you have a lot more to say about that, and I'm curious to hear you get into it.
Two things I think are, it is exactly as you said, there is this polarization, and I guess both sides of the polarization are just wrong. There is, to my own experience, a lot that went wrong, and there's a lot of motives of Andrew that have to be questioned. But knowing him as much as I know him, and I was close to him for several years, I'm deeply convinced that he had a deep commitment to something completely beyond him that also drove him. And part of his also strength as a human being and also his transmission came out of something that I feel is a deep spiritual realization of whatever you want to call it. And that just has to be also in the picture. And it doesn't make the complexity less complex. It makes it more complex, but it's there. And it has to be seen. And if we talk about questions, is something like enlightenment real? Is spirituality spiritual? Is consciousness real? What does a progressive spirituality mean anyway? Is this something that goes beyond an atheist kind of mutuality? Is there something to the depth of consciousness and spirit? These are all questions, and I have my own answer to that. I'm deeply convinced of the reality of consciousness and the primacy of consciousness. And the other part that you were kind of hitting on, this intersubjective enlightenment, is just something that I know happened in the context of what Andrew created. There was this really dramatic time around 2001, where Andrew was in a kind of, you can call it warfare, with his closest students for months and months to pull them into a place beyond them And that was in his ashram in Western Massachusetts. And I happened to be there for this time. And it was, in many ways, rightful or not rightful, extreme time. But it resulted in something where people came together in a recognition of an intersubjective space between them, a reality of consciousness that is beyond our separate self-sense, that I still believe is very, very real and very significant. Because my whole take on life changed from this to really realize that even my individuality is part of a huge, undivided unfolding of consciousness. It doesn't take away from my individuality, and that's also something that we have to discuss, because one of the dangers of recognizing V-spaces is that a V-space also can close down our individuality, and you come to kind of a lower V-space where basically our individual judgment is locked out. And this pre-trans fallacy that is similar to the pre-trans fallacy around rationality, there's an individuality pre-trans fallacy, is a very dangerous one. But to really have the experience that we as human beings can come together in the recognition that consciousness is one and it's unfolding, and we, as we are talking right now, are on one hand individuals talking, but on the other hand, we are also just agents of this unfolding of evolution. We are, is something that I think is of significance, how we think about our time, how we think about culture, and how we think about ego and transcendence of ego.
This is touching me on a number of different levels, because it seems to me that there is always an eternal both-and tension between Eros and Agape. And that in me which is committed to breaking through limitation and transcending and actually doing something true and good and beautiful and new and innovative and breaking through the old boundaries needs in certain ways to be very bold, to be willing to dare to get it wrong, to take the risk of trying something that isn't already known to be fully safe and might even violate the boundaries of somebody else in the service of doing something truly new and valuable. And that is a value that needs not to be lost completely. On the other hand, there's a certain kind of feeling, empathy, and regard for the humanity and the vulnerability and the worth of every human being. I know that at times both Adida and Andrew expressed attitudes that were so contemptuous of the ordinary humanity of people that I could never adopt those attitudes without losing touch with something very important in terms of how I navigate. You know, I do something like teaching now. I would never do anything vaguely like any of these things. You know, my way of teaching is to be not even in a superior status, but to be a practitioner, just a fellow practitioner along the way, a friend, not separating myself in any way, but giving myself fully to my own practice in a way that is hopefully an inspiring example, and doing it in a way that presses me beyond limits so that there's an example that has Eros in it, but doing it always in a way that's so deeply respectful of others that agape principle of human love is never lost. And it sometimes appears to me that in the evolution of Dharma, it may have been that there was a certain cultural function served by having some people whose realizations had an explosive force that made them willing to be ruthlessly demanding in a way that I could say is probably true for both Adida and Andrew. such that there were students who could be catapulted way beyond their own preference pattern and their own ego pattern. And I think that something was served in me through my submission to that. But it's hardly a model for anything going forward. And in fact, when I look at what I see you doing, I see you actually exactly being the opposite, in a way, of the things that are criticized in Andrew, even though in some levels you seem to be appreciating what he accomplished in your case. What you're doing is coming together with people who have completely different dharmas from yours, anthroposophical leaders and people in the integral movement, and creating collaborative containers that are able to create a productive engagement for diverse points of view. And in doing that, you're being profoundly respectful rather than harshly contemptuous of what seems different from your own view, which means that there has to be a change at the very heart, and the behavior is different. And it seems to me that there must be some sort of a dharma arriving from that that is, at least on some levels, a bit of a critique of the dharma that matured you into what you're doing now. What do you think of that?
It's definitely true. Because on one hand, there is this deep appreciation of this radical experiment that we're in and this ruthlessness, because it created some recognition of the depth humans can meet in, that just deeply changed me. And it is something where I think to go to recognize really deeply our separate self sense, you need the recognition of something beyond the self sense for real to allow yourself to be drawn by it. But at the same time, and that's what I try to do also in the way how I try to develop our work, also in kind of a process of self-criticizing our work, is to see this unfolding of this oneness that Andrew would call theros as a dialogical process, where I hold one voice in this dialogue, and my understanding is one voice in this dialogue, but the process that we're in, this unfolding of consciousness, is always bigger than my voice. And what I create, what we create, my contribution is only a contribution if it's a contribution to something bigger than myself. And one of the mistakes, and it's a classical mistake of any cult, to think that basically we are it. I think we are never it. We are always a contribution to something bigger. And what I learned, and what I also learned in my collaboration here in Germany with the integral movement here and with the anthroposophic movement and other progressive spiritual movements, that there's an unbelievable creativity possible in holding the space of dialogue. And at the same time, and that's again kind of a contradictory situation, I think that holding this space of dialogue comes also directly from this deep recognition of this oneness of this process that is something that I got from our experiment in EnlightenX, a deep realization that consciousness is moving as one in diversity, and then allow this to be in service of this process. And in that, I don't necessarily see a contradiction between Eros and Agape, because it is one unfolding process that needs the respect and the love for the people who are holding it, but it needs also deep respect for this process itself unfolding. And how deep is my relationship that I really care more than just my personal life, in a way that there's something we are humanity is for, there's something our history is for, where we as humans really unfold something very profound, which is the good, the truth, and the beautiful unfolding. How deeply
am I willing to commit myself, and how much am I willing to really give what I have with my life for this unfolding of this good, beautiful and truth as one. And then when people come together in this, something very great, something very powerful can unfold. But usually it needs a lot of work also on one's own egoic motivations, on one's separation, and also a recognition that there is more than us. There's a depth in life, if you call it divine, however you want to call it, there's something that is very important in the foundation of all of it, which has a sacred dimension. That is what I'm deeply convinced of, and we can talk about it, if this is illusion or not illusion. I think this is something real, and I'm willing to have a conversation if it's real or not.
Beautiful. And you're really getting down to the nub of something here, because I feel like this debate gets dumbed down. You know, there's an incontrovertible truth in the critiques of some of Andrew's excesses. It's never okay to be that harsh. It's that he blew it in a certain way. There is a critique that I think can't be argued with. On the other hand, there is a baby in this. He did that in the service of this transcendent progression of consciousness and culture and breaking people beyond limits that otherwise would have been very hard to exceed. And he felt certain that the only way he could do it was to be unrelentingly, ruthlessly tough. Well, whether that's right or wrong, something may have been accomplished there. And to throw the baby out with the bathwater is a problem too. Somehow we have to hold both of these values with real seriousness and passion if we're going to have this dialogue in a meaningful way. And ultimately the point of this isn't to pass judgment on Andrew. His story's not over anyway. He hopefully will learn from this in ways that will enable him to emerge and give the gift of his awakening through this to the rest of us in a way that will enrich spiritual culture. That's a story that isn't told yet. But what's alive for us now isn't looking at him, but looking at ourselves. And it seems to me that what has emerged from your experience with this that's really exciting to me is a commitment to give your passionate engagement beyond a certain level of egoity that did get burned off in this fierce cauldron with Andrew to something that is greater than yourself, that is collaborative. And it's this kind of conversation. This conversation we're having now is one element in the larger churn of that larger cultural conversation that actually is the beginning of us forging a sangha that could be the next Buddha. And our willingness to give ourselves unreservedly with purity of heart, with self-transcending passion, but also with compassion for each other, to that, that's the game that's going on in town. And that's exciting.
No, you're very right, Terry. And in fact, you named my motive of doing what I'm doing very precisely. I am deeply convinced there is a baby, and I'm deeply convinced we must not throw out the baby. And then we can argue, is there a baby in this experiment that we created with Enlightenment Next? Is there something valid? Is this a kind of intersubjective enlightenment, as we call it, something real, not real? We can talk about it. I personally, not only that I'm deeply convinced that it's real, my work as it is unfolding here, we just had here in Frankfurt, a beautiful training today with people who are jumping into what we call a higher we training, where to my sense there's a deep understanding of the realness of being not separate as we are human beings in this world that comes or has the strength also from this realization out of our experiment. There's something that I think is very valuable that I am not willing to throw out. At the same time, there are many things, and it's not only Andrew, it's also our culture that we have to look into. And we are in the midst of it. There's still many things that have to unfold, that we have to criticize, that we have to look into, but also that is how evolution works. when you study history, evolution always works in complicated ways. There are never breakthroughs that are kind of clean and neat. It's always a complicated process. Mistakes are made, motives are wrong, terrible mistakes are made. In all of that, what has value? And I think the recognition of the non-separation of the human spirit and the non-separation of consciousness as it is unfolding this world, all what lies underneath an evolutionary spirituality or an evolutionary enlightenment, is something very real and very important, and that can and must inform culture. And what I want to do here in Germany is just to create one hub where something, an experiment is created, but very different to what we thought we did with Enlightened Next. I think this is one experiment, and I'm happy with the other experiments, and I'm very happy to work together to learn from the others, because this is not a monolithic development of something. We try our best here to develop something. I know others try their best here. Let's compare notes and let's see what's happening. This is how evolution works.
Wow, beautiful. Well, I want to charge ahead, but we're at that time when it's an opportunity to invite questions from listeners. So if you're calling in on the phone, you can press *2. And if you're listening online, you can type your question in on the web page on your computer monitor. Meanwhile, I'd like to make sure you know how to find out more about Tom's work. If you can read auf Deutsch, or if you can just use Google Translate or Google Chrome, you can visit evolve-magazine, magazin.de, enlightennext.de, and Herbst Academy, Herbstakademie-Frankfurt, Frankfurt.de. And you can find out about some of Tom's current projects. But the main thing he wants you to be aware of is the Global Meditation Marathon that will be happening this December. For 24 hours, over 30 hours, between December 13th and the 14th, people from all over the world will be meditating together. Why? Because spirit has no limit. It is infinite. It has no boundaries. It knows no separation. Through meditation, we can directly participate in the fact that the heart and the depth of the human spirit is one, indivisible and whole. In our crazy, conflict-ridden, fragmented world, we need powerful reminders that we share one humanity. There's no rich or poor in meditation, no young, no old, no man or woman, no black or white, or Muslim or Hindu or Christian or Jew. There is unity. The home website for this is meditationmarathon.de. Tom and his evolutionary partners are joining people from many traditions and from the Trans Path in this initiative, which invites us all to discover for ourselves the power of coming together in silence and stillness with others from different corners of the globe, awaken to the meditative current running beneath the surface of all life, encounter the living mystery at the core of yourself. Join the 6th Global Virtual Meditation Marathon on December 13th and 14th, at meditationmarathon.de, because spirit has no limit. That's meditationmarathon.de. Additionally, I want you to be aware of some of my own offerings. I have continued to deepen in my practice and spiritual life and have been listening not only to the mystery, the divine, universal source of love and goodness and sacredness and silence, beyond description, but I've also been learning to trust and listen at new depths to the voice of my own soul. There can seem to be two kinds of mystical practice, one that opens beyond self into love and freedom, and another that surrenders into the depths of the psyche and the natural world and one's personal soul nature. And recently, as my own practice has taken a soulful turn, I've understood a lot of new things about the relationship of these two dimensions, and I've been teaching about it actively. I call it integral soul work, and I was just teaching about it in Europe, and it's, I'm so excited. There are transformations and clarities and integrations happening for many people as a result of this work, and I'm very excited about it. If you'd like to know something about what I'm doing there, there's an introductory talk I gave in January as I was just really powering into this, and it's available for free at integralsoulwork.com. You're also invited to experience it with me at an upcoming event. For the rest of this year, I'll only be teaching in Mexico and Guatemala. That'll be at the end of November and the beginning of December. There will be other events posted soon for 2015. To find out about all of those things, just go to my website, terrypatton.com. And if you're curious to know about what I'm up to, you can sign up for my mailing list there. If you click events, you'll find out more details about the events I'm mentioning and links to the registration pages. Now let's take a look at the questions. Remember, if you've called in on the phone, you can press star 2. Okay, looking over at what's happening. Ooh, there's a lot going on here. Okay. Well, let's start with a live question. It's always lively. So there's a cell phone with Arlington, Massachusetts as its code, a 339 cell phone. You're
Hi, yes.
On the air.
Hi, Terry. Hi, Tom. This is Randy Austell. And thanks for having this conversation. You hear me?
Yes. Please. Yes. Great. Thanks for introducing yourself, Randy. Please continue.
Yeah, so I have three comments I'd like to make, and I'd be curious what your feedback is. First of all, I am grateful to Andrew for even attempting to be a 21st century integral evolutionary guru. If he hadn't tried to do that, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And so I think it sort of was a bold effort on his part, and I think it's an important question as to what that guru role is, and I appreciate him making that effort. Secondly, I was at the Boulder event over New Year's at Integral Center, and we did a fascinating exercise where we broke into threesomes, and each of us took the turn being the guru for the threesome. And I hadn't thought of it till just now, but that it seemed that the guru role was something almost anybody could inhabit, and there seemed to be something positive that each of us got out of both being in the guru role and being in the disciple role. And I don't know if that says something about going forward, what the guru role possibility is, but it did seem like it was something that was still alive in some way and that we could share it. And thirdly, I'm a student of Patricia Albert and Jeff Carrera in the Evolutionary Collective. And one of the things that I know they talk about a lot is to what degree they as teachers are influenced by who's in the room. And, you know, we've been talking about Andrew as if he's sort of an autonomous separate individual with his motivations and his whatever he was. And I certainly, he certainly is an autonomous individual and is capable of making his own decisions. But I think going forward, we really need to be aware of the degree to which everybody in the room influences the space and influences what happens. And it's sometimes we don't understand how that is happening. You know, it may not be what we're intentionally contributing to this space, but that what happens in the group is to some degree a function of all of the people in the room. And so I think that more and more that's going to be a factor going forward. Thank you.
Tom, do you have something you want to say in response to that?
Thank you for saying what you said about Andrew, because whatever mistakes he made, what you said is just true. And that someone like him took a risk like this
even with the failure that is also part of his story, is something that many people don't dare to do, because you also have to have a lot of courage to stand out and risk something like this. It has also to be said. About what you said, that it's not just Andrew as an individual, but basically it's created by the whole culture. I think this is a very very important point, and it's something that we also have to look when we look about the history of Enlightened Next. Of course, the structure of this influence is different in a network reality or in a pyramid hierarchy reality. So there's more responsibility to the top of a pyramid. When you really have a pyramid hierarchy, then you have a network reality where basically all parts are kind of influencing the sphere of culture in the same way. But still, even the pyramid way, and particularly also in creating the pyramid, it's a whole culture that creates this. So in that sense, you never just can blame an individual, although individuals have a huge choice. It's always also the culture.
Thanks very much.
I'm going to go to some of the questions. There are a lot of questions, and I'd like to combine three for you to respond to right now, Tom. John in Daly City asked, can you say what actually happened that brought down Andrew specifically when it did so long after all those years of abuse? And then Samadhi in Amsterdam asks, what we've come to recognize is that almost all of us have been abusing each other in line of what Andrew expressed. The higher in the hierarchy, the more this has been part of being in the organization. Does Tom have something to say about this, and does he have personal regrets of what he has done at the time? And then Muhammad in London asks, if you can go back to the question I asked about the fact of the polarization, how to best reconcile the issues that have arisen out of the falling apart of Enlightened Next. Those all seem to follow on what Randy just raised, Tom, and I want to give you a chance to be challenged again.
What was the first question? Can you say it again? Sorry.
The first question was John asking, can you say what exactly happened that brought Andrew down, specifically when it did, so long after all those years of abuse?
What I can say is that there was a period of time where some closer students of Andrew just came to the point that things have to change in the way we do our culture, and confronted Andrew with that. And that took a couple of time, and in fact, Andrew did not respond to this in a way that we found exactly what Andrew himself was asking for, that we do this together in a way. So there was a real also internal reckoning that we have to change our culture and have to go in a different way. And there would have been the possibility of Andrew also to respond to this in a way. And if he would have responded, maybe things would have unfolded in a different way. But still, at that point already, a lot of things have been gone wrong. But I think what brought Andrew down in the way it did was that at this crucial point, where I think that would have been the last moment to really, from the inside out, see, we have done mistakes, we have to do things differently, we have to learn. Andrew was not willing to make this step, although he was challenged by a very close student to do so. In terms of we all are kind of abused each other, I wouldn't say it in this general way. I think this happens in many ways, but also I think some things that are called abuse are forms that I see as challenging in a positive way, and one has to look very closely. And I mean, there are things I do regret, but in general, I think
we made mistakes, and we also the way I particularly tried to do what I do in Germany was trying to learn from these mistakes and find different ways. And I think one of the reasons why what we are doing here in Germany is still very much alive and going in new directions is because maybe we also learned lessons earlier. That's at least what I hope.
Now, that kind of begs a few questions, though. Did you abuse other people? Do you regret how you participated? How do you feel about Andrew? One person in Stuttgart asked if when Andrew's finished his sabbatical, if you're planning to work with him again. There's an edge in some of these questions of really wanting me to challenge you more firmly, because it isn't acceptable to simply get philosophical in the face of real hurt. And in your reckoning with this, are you willing to go a step further than you've gone so far in examining your own collusion with something that may have gone overboard and become dark, even if it had a truly spiritual purpose in its original justification?
These are different questions that is kind of which I also would like to respond in the difference, because in the question about abuse, I think I made mistakes. I don't think in the strong sense of abuse that I abuse people. I really don't think so. And at the same time, I did collude with things I should not have colluded with, and this I also do regret. And I think that's what we as a culture have to think, and also people who were closely connected with Andrew, why we went so far in colluding this, and also the mistakes that we did, to be very, very real about them, and at least I try to do so.
Okay, good. Thank you. Beautiful. Let's take another live question. This one is from Philadelphia, phone number 267 area code. You're on the air.
That's me. And this is interesting. I'm going to try not to talk too long, but I have a lot of things that are running through my head. My name is Debbie.
Please do make it as focused and brief as you can.
I will. My name is Debbie. I was briefly a student of Andrew's. I did go to a retreat in Massachusetts and went to some activities in Philadelphia and was part of the Philadelphia community. I'm very drawn to this conversation because before I was involved with Andrew, I was involved with Werner Erhard. And he has quite a reputation for abuse, and I was quite badly abused in some ways. So I understand what it is that that people are talking about, and I understand my involvement in that when I was involved with the Werner-type stuff. I never was a student at a high enough level in Andrew's work to be engaged in any of that stuff. However, there are a couple of things that come up for me. At the retreat I went to in Massachusetts, Jeff and Andrew were giving a history of Enlighten Next and talked about this period of time when this discovery was made about working together and getting each other. You know, I don't have the right language, so I hope you guys can follow me. But talked about it being something that happened mostly among the men. And there were various conversations about things that happened among women. But there was nothing that ever really resonated for me. And one of the things that strikes me about some of the themes that you've been speaking about is that it is thought that women have a gentler nature in relating to each other. I know that's not always true. But I'm wondering if somehow a better integration of women into the community and into the leadership might, let's not talk about the past, might be something that you guys want to look at in terms of moving forward. And then there's the second thing I wanted to comment about was that having been in the environment I had been in, I with Werner to begin with, and then with Andrew, I was not able to continue following a path because of circumstances in my life. And what I had to do in that part of my life was to stop abusing people, because I became very good at abusing people and it not being kind. I learned that message too well. And although it's for the purpose of growth, I was not as careful as I should have been about the environment and the listening that I was in. So I can see that this is very
common. Okay, we need to wrap this up.
That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you. Tom, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, just very short. Integrating women in leadership is a very crucial question, for not just for us as kind of a spiritual movement, but for us as a culture. I think this is just part. What it means, there's a lot to be talked about, but I think it is a very important part.
And I think that these issues of abuse are really big in the general stream of questions. We've gotten so many questions typed in that we're not going to get to all of them, I can see, and although I wish we would. One question from a very different angle I'd like to bring to you right away. Kay in Washington, D.C. asks, one thing I personally regret about the dissolution of Enlightened X is that it served as, at some level, as a container for a global network of evolutionary spiritual practitioners. Now that that container is gone, and with it the sense of a global evolutionary spiritual movement, is this a loss? Is there a chance of the global network resurrecting in some other way? Could Tom speak to this?
Very simple. Yes, it is a tremendous loss, as I see it. And in which way ever, not as Enlightened Next necessarily, but a global network of people, spirited people who really try to work for a different evolutionary culture, is something that I think is of greatest importance. We have to work together, but not as a monolithic movement, but as a kind of movements that are working together and create a global culture that is talking to each other while looking where the next step in human culture.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good. Let me take another live question from Linda Hilliker. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Terry. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to point out, I was a student of Andrew's from 2003 until the beginning of 2006. And Tom, we met. I actually was assistant to Elizabeth DeBold for the Conscious Evolution Graduate Program. But anyway, I just wanted to make a point about where people are at in their development and how they interpret their experiences. Because I just helped out with a conference last weekend at the Integral Center with Terry O'Fallon and Kim Barta. And what we really looked into very deeply was the full spectrum of development and where people were at in their development when they had trauma, and then how that affects essentially what the resolution or moving past that would be. And so I've had tremendous experiences with Enlightened Next. It actually had shifted to Enlightened Next during the time that I was there. And conscious evolution and the community experience and what happens in the field when people are deeply meditating was just beyond my wildest expectations of what was possible in community. It was just truly stunning. So I also experienced what it was like to have my personal needs be completely ignored in favor of the group. And so I think there was some balance there that really would have been more fruitful for people. But I just wanted to point out that everyone who was involved in EnlightenX made a choice to be there. And so I'm very fortunate because I was very curious about what was going on, and no matter what happened, I was very focused on how would I grow from that experience and to learn from that experience, whatever way that would be. And so I just want to invite people to consider, you know, that there's something about development and our past experiences and so on that has something to do with how we interpret our experience with Andrew, and that there might be something there to be understood. And I think that Terry's developmental model and working with Kim Barta, who specializes in helping people to clear trauma, has many insights that could be helpful in people taking the next steps. So just wanted to offer that.
Okay. Thank you, Linda. I'm not sure that that requires an answer from you, Tom, but let me go on to a question that absolutely demands an answer from you, a very challenging question from someone you know. Michael Wambacher types in, I was involved with Andrew Cohen for 15 years, and I know Tom personally. I've now moved on from Enlightened Next, and it is actually striking to me to hear Tom speak in the same way that he used to, and it really sounds like nothing has changed. For someone intelligent like him, I was hoping he had thought about it all in a more sophisticated way and deconstructed the dynamics and the theory more deeply. But it's sad to see intelligent people like him with enormous potential are still stuck psychologically in an old way of thinking. One example is how many times he says the word beyond. So many times, in the same way that we used to imply it. The underlying meaning is that there is something with me in the now, or with everything current, that we need to go beyond. Consciousness is not beyond. It is real and here. So my question to Tom, don't you think you need more time to think before you keep going with the work of Enlightened Next?
I definitely need more time, and I keep going with the work. Basically, I think it's an ongoing learning process, and what we try to do here is, in our own ways, maybe good enough in the eyes of some people or many people, but it is our attempt to learn as we try to also do our work and learn by doing this, and that's exactly what we try to do. We definitely will make our own mistakes, but at the same time, we also want to do our work here and try to have a contribution.
What about his questioning of this use of the word beyond in the sense of things being here and now?
I love the word beyond, and I love the word here and now. And I think part of the here and now is also that in the here and now there is always a horizon of beyondness. That the power of human consciousness is that we can be completely here. At the same time, in being completely here, there's always a potential arising. And that's basically how life works. Life is always growing somewhere, and conscious life is consciously growing somewhere, growing beyond the status quo, at the same time being completely here as a living being and growing.
Well, I'm going to accept that, being that we're on a program that I called Beyond Awakening. There's another question that was typed in by someone I know well, Jeff Charno. He wants to ask something very specific, and I think it's a useful question. What exactly is the baby we're concerned about not throwing away? I think there were several, Jeff, that I referred to it, but let's ask it of Tom. Are we talking, he goes on to say, are we talking about glimpses of the ground or awakened awareness? Are we talking about stabilizing this kind of awakening? Or are we talking about some version of what might be called preliminary practice in Buddhism, the establishment of a level of functioning and deepening of motivation and purification of personality and so forth? Or are we talking about the further maturing which continues after initial clarification of awakening? People can awaken to the ground without submitting to a guru. So given these distinctions, please clarify the baby you're so concerned with not throwing away.
Oh, there are several babies. One baby is very simple. The spirit is real. And this is not something specific to our work, but it's specific to any authentic spiritual work. The
spirit beyond our ego is real. But the very thing that I mean with the baby is the recognition that we as real human beings can come together in a consciousness of togetherness that is an alive form of being together that is beyond our individuality, at the same time is held by our individuality. There's a higher form of free space that I think is the edge of our human development. There's something that we deeply are as we are in the 21st century, individual human beings, and at the same time we can come together in a field of togetherness that is beyond this separation. And that we experience, I think, in a very profound way that has meaning and that is deeply inspiring my work here.
And that's maybe the most important baby that you want to refer to, even though there are other babies that you don't want to throw out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think I want to speak to this question myself and maybe say some different things. I want to make sure that we don't throw away the fierce, passionate aliveness of this as an adventure. I don't think that the spiritual path is simply a rational, systematic process of development. I actually do think that there is a true mystical adventure and that there are opportunities for transcendence that are worth taking risks for and giving our hearts to. I think that there's a potential for a kind of taking of risks and a kind of wildness and a kind of willingness to dare to go beyond the safe ground of what's proven that has value. And that's a baby that I don't want to see get thrown out with the bathwater. On the other hand, there's another baby which has to do with the incredible tenderness and sacredness of every single human individual. And I don't want to let that get thrown out with the bathwater of ego and the argument of ego transcendence. And I think that there's another baby, which is the living, passionate experiment on the edge of all of this that we're potentially engaging now. And although there are really important philosophical questions here, and I think that there are principles, and I think that there are all kinds of dimensions of this that we can talk about in a cooler way, I don't want the baby of my own passionate heart engagement with these things to be thrown out into the abstraction of my intellectual engagement with it. All of those things are really up for me right now. I'm feeling excited that we've been able to have this dialogue, Tom. I know that it's really not over. The questions keep coming in. There's passion in them. There are so many really great questions that we didn't get a chance to respond to, but we are at the end of the time that we had promised to finish this at. So let me say a few things here as we get closer to our conclusion. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this at beyondawakeningseries.com. If you're interested in learning more about Tom Steininger, and if you speak German or you can use Google Translate or Google Chrome, please visit Evolve Magazine, evolve-magazin.de, enlightennext.de, herbstacademy-frankfurt.de. But most of all, Tom wants to invite you to consider the 6th Global Virtual Meditation Marathon that he's helping to organize along with many others. It will take place December 13th and 14th, and you can find out about it at meditationmarathon.de. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter and find out about my upcoming teaching events. And if you're specifically interested in learning about integral soul work, you can download a free 75-minute teleseminar at integralsoulwork.com. My next dialogue will be a very passionate spiritual conversation with the remarkable Andrew Harvey that will be broadcast in just 2 weeks on October 19th. And finally, thank you very much, Tom, for being here with me. This has been a rich conversation. It feels like it's part one, and we've both admitted that we're not all the way through this and that there's more, and perhaps we'll find our way into a part two.
Yeah, let's talk about this. I'm sure there will at some point be much more to talk about it, and this is an ongoing conversation we all have to have.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me. So there are quite a few people on the line. Let's open up the mics for everyone and invite everybody to say goodbye as we finish up this call. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks, Carrie.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.